This is CliffCentral.com.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuri. As usual, I'm going to be your host for the next hour. Thanks for tuning in. Unfortunately, my comrade Greg Nicholson is not in studio with us today. He's off living his best life, but at some point he'll join us at some point in the future. But I'm here, so it's better than nothing. Thanks for talking to us on Twitter at DM Shows IDA. Thank you for everybody who's messaging us at Glenn Tyler, at IsiZulu. Thank you for the kind words, the commentary, and for the support. It's really cool to just get feedback on the shows you're enjoying and the shows you're sharing. And it's, yeah, it makes the work way more fun when there's people on the other side of the internet who are, you know, talking to us. Okay. Time to get right into it. Someone we've been trying to have on the show for a while. And despite my best efforts, it didn't happen until the universe just made it happen, which I suppose how life always works. Professor Phumla Dineo-Xola, thank you for being here. How are you today?
Thank you very much for having me, Kingsley. It's good to be here.
You've had a lot going on. I mean, you've first wrote your two books, one about slavery, one, Renegade Calls and Piwe. And then last year we saw the amazing success of your book, Rape, A South African Nightmare, award-winning. How are you feeling? What's that experience been like?
I'm feeling quite good, yeah. But it's been quite surprising, you know, because you... welcome and surprising, right? So I'm not going to even pretend it doesn't matter. It matters a great deal. Okay. It's been really humbling to see people receive, especially slavery initially, but also much more so kind of rape more recently.
Yeah.
So it's been absolutely wonderful. I'm still a little shocked and a little overwhelmed, but in the best possible way.
And the book launch last week, I had a chance to be there, was flooded. I think I was standing out on the street. So many people, such a warm reception. On the other hand, I'm conscious that you're an academic. You've written a lot in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Does it get easier to put your words out into the world? Or is it just now routine to say, I write stuff, people read it? Or is there still a apprehension?
Well, no, I certainly... Yeah. I don't know if one ever gets to that point, but I certainly am not there. I'm not at that point where I think, oh, well, this is just what I do. It doesn't require any effort. I feel really like I feel like I'm two writing selves, right? Okay. There is a certain level of ease that comes with kind of my kind of conventional academic work, right? Because I've been doing it for 21 years. So it kind of, there's a certain way in which I can write, academic criticism, scholarship, quite quickly without and care about it deeply. Of course, I don't like to write about anything that I don't care deeply about, either something what animates me in a good way or enrages me. But I don't write very well about things that I'm lukewarm about. But I think with the nonfiction, it's incredible how. It, even though it's a register that I come to quite late, it's a form of writing that I come to quite late.
Mm.
It's incredible how much more it seems to resonate with people. And so it feels like something that I'm still kind of working on, and I'm probably more tortured, in terms of what to include in each book. With the nonfiction that I am, with kind of, you know, a chapter, an academic chapter, or and so on. But you know what, Kingsley, it's all work that I love, right? So okay. So even when I'm saying I'm tortured probably because I'm so obsessed with how and every single bit, and you know, it has to read right, it has to feel right, it has to. So I care about that stuff. So that's why it's tortured. But it's not tortured in the sense that I would ever give it up.
Okay. For those wondering what book we're actually talking about, which I should have said earlier, book I'm holding in my hand, and I'll tweet a picture of it shortly, Reflecting Rogue Inside the Mind of a Feminist. And inside you describe it as reflections on country, self, family, community, pleasure, violence, reflections of and on living, loving, and thinking as a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
One feminist.
Yep.
That's a lot.
Is it?
that's a lot.
Well, I mean, I live in the world as myself, and myself is a feminist, right? So it affects everything I do. It doesn't even affect everything I do. It shades everything I could do. It's such a central part of who I am. So I think that my tastes have everything to do with my feminism. I think that, you know, my desires have been shaped by my relationship to myself, you know, everything. And so, yes, but it's not... So I think that it's something that many other people who are feminists will probably relate to, but probably people who don't necessarily self-identify as feminists might relate to parts of it because I am human. But it's just, it's one feminist, right? So it's definitely not I don't make any claims about this is how feminists arrive at love because there's so many different kinds of us and we're all human beings. So while the politics and the intention and the approach, there'll be obvious, clear, similarities and people will recognize themselves. But yes, of course, it's also me. So I have my own quirks and my own mess and my own weirdnesses.
No, and they really come through and I love the personal stories. And one thing is just, I mean, looking specifically at your feminism is you recall your grandmother, I believe, telling you to sit like a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of reflect on why she might have said that and what in her life. And I just found it so interesting how you're able to one, experience that as just an instruction and then also think deeply and say what might be behind that.
Well, I haven't always, I will thank you, Kingsley, but I haven't always been that clever about it and generous about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I fought my Nkhunu bitterly about the sitting thing. And of course, I was little and she was my grandmother. So even as I was fighting with her, the way you raised, you can't fight directly with her, but I didn't want to sit the way she was saying.
And culturally, you can't.
Exactly. And also, she's my grandmother and I was a little girl. And so I didn't want to listen to her, but I couldn't not listen to her. But at the same time, I didn't want to keep quiet.
Yeah.
And so, and certainly I didn't always think, I think the empathy for, I mean, I was very close to her. Mm. So this sitting thing was like a big thing because she wasn't generally conservative, right? She was generally quite quirky and magnanimous. But she had very strong ideas about girls' bodies.
Yeah.
And the sitting thing was a huge thing for her. And it drove me completely insane. So, so you say you like, part of what you like is how I'm able to kind of try to understand where she's coming from. I think that's come with age.
Okay.
I think that's come with trying to think about, you know, she's been dead for almost 2 decades now. And I think it's come with thinking, well, why does this thing matter so much, right? Because, I mean, there's many things that I did with her in my life and that she said and probably things that I got more upset about as a teenager. So why does this thing matter so much? And there were probably other things, you know, there were many other things that she said that didn't irritate me, that excited me or that whatever. But with age, of course, I had to think, oh my God, you know, and sometimes also because I see bits of her in me, right? Mm. She was very willful.
Okay.
She was born in Lesotho. And she moved from Lesotho to come marry my grandfather in South Africa. She'd never been to South Africa.
Wow.
Right? And I'm just like, oh my God, you know, just she lived all these kind of things. And so I thought, well, you know, she wasn't a coward, small woman. So what is it that makes a woman like that, who is very willful, who does all these things, who speaks her mind, be so persistent, right? Like what might, and then I suppose that then came with, well, how do I think about this critically, but lovingly, rather than like the all powerful grandmother? Because as I've grown older, of course, I've realized like, well, hello, grow up in a British protectorate.
Yeah.
Move your country, give birth to your, like, marry your sweetheart that you spend your whole life, like, 5 decades with. But also, you have 5 tiny kids in 1948, right? Like, oh my God, like, the world is changing and it's not getting better, right? So, who is that grandmother? And what is her experience of living in a black girl and a black woman's body look like? And what does she teach her children? What does what else could have been going on in that moment?
Mm. I feel like a theme throughout the book is this, it's just generations and just sort of who comes before and who comes after.
Really?
I think
I like that. I didn't think
Is, Do you think moments like that, when you try to understand what's behind what people are saying, does that perhaps give you a gentler approach to feminists or older people who've just come before you, and perhaps some idea that you feel maybe misguided or not quite aligned with you? Are you just a bit gentler, you know, when you put yourself in their shoes?
Well, I don't look, Kinsley, I'm not that generous, right? I don't necessarily want I'm not, she's my grandmother,
yeah,
so maybe,
so it's
you
easier,
know.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think empathy is underrated, right? Okay. But at the same time, there are people that I don't want to be okay. empathetic towards, right? There are people that I don't. So I'm not necessarily, I mean, there's kind of misogyny and patterns of violence that I'm not interested in being sympathetic okay. towards. So, I mean, I think, yes, it helps to try to understand. I can't help myself. I'm incurably curious about why.
Okay.
Why things are happening the way they are, what it means that they're happening in this way. But I'm not always willing to extend myself to try to sympathetically or empathetically, I might want to understand it. But for example, I don't really want to understand and feel empathy for someone who, I don't know, wakes up and shoots their whole family.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want to be inside that person's
okay.
brain.
Okay.
I don't necessarily want to be inside the brain of someone who wakes up and slits the throat of his life partner or rapes someone or... or that kind of thing. So yes, I mean, I think there's value in it, but I think it has limitations. Because otherwise then everything is understandable, right?
In context, everything's
yes.
okay. Then
yes.
I hear you. Going back to your childhood, I think I'm just struck by the determination. Like, I feel like sit like a girl, I can feel baby Pumla already being like, not gonna happen. Stop climbing trees. Sorry. Not gonna happen. It's mm-hmm. really just about how to push back, but it's not gonna happen.
Mm-hmm.
Was that determination in ways that played out, especially with this not fitting into the mold of girlhood, I guess, that was there? Was that, this sounds, at least from the book, innate as something that was just simply always there?
Yes, it
yeah.
was. But you know, in
yeah.
the last, as I've become a parent myself,
yeah.
in you know, I've realized that a lot of kids, you know, sometimes
yeah.
when you watch little children, not just mine, but even in public spaces, before they sort of 10, they seem to have no sense of self-preservation, right? So they're climbing, they like, all the adults are holding their breath because they're thinking you're going to poke your eye
oh,
out,
yeah.
you're going to split your skull. Why are you hanging like that? Why are you climbing like that? Can you not see how close you are to the edge? Can you not see how you're going to burn yourself, wet yourself, kill yourself, you know? I actually think that maybe most children start out like that and then are taught
okay.
to police. Then we are taught as we get older and sometimes more successfully for some people than others. Then we're taught, you know, the a friend of mine, Angelo Fick, likes to say, you know, sometimes he feels like some of the ways in which we're educated, we have the imagination disciplined out of us. So I think a similar kind of thing happens. So I think that we, as you know, we start out as kids who assume and until something happens, unless something happens
yeah,
to you very young,
yeah.
or you're taught this constantly, eventually you unlearn it, who think that the world is ours and who are curious and who think, huh, if it occurs to me to climb up, maybe I should climb up, until one day you're told, well, no, don't climb up, or you're smacked, or you're shamed enough times, or because even when you fall, I mean, children hurt themselves all the time.
Yeah.
I hurt myself. I mean, I liked climbing, but I was extremely ungraceful. I was not like
so
a nimble.
You're not particularly talented at climbing.
No, I was terrible at it. But it gave me, so
yeah.
I fell, I think out of every 3 times I climbed anything, I fell once. And even my adult body,
yeah.
there are faded marks from, I mean, and there's pictures of me as a child
yeah.
of like, you know, like, oh, I marks on my body
yeah.
from falling so much. So it isn't, so clearly then the falling and the failure to kind of discover, like to successfully climb up things, yeah. And so on, it wasn't a deterrent.
Mm.
I think it's the social stuff. It's the sit like a girl. It's the nobody wants to see your panties. You're not thinking about your panties if you're wearing a little skirt and you're five, right? It's the girls aren't supposed to do that. It's that stuff, I think. So I think it's taught. And so yes, I think it was innate, but increasingly I'm starting to think that it seems innate in a lot of children. It's something we as part of training into proper adulthood or proper adolescence that we taught to disown.
And another remarkable part of your childhood, I think, is the way you contextualize it within the University of Fort Hare.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this beautiful scene where you describe, you know, a young Pumla trying to say black power or successfully saying it for the first time. I mean, for you know, me who's a bit younger and for other people who maybe are not, you know, too familiar with the context, can you describe what it was like growing up in that space, 70s and 80s, just like what it was, what it meant?
Absolutely. So I was born in December 1972, on the 3rd of December 1972. So, and my dad lectured organic chemistry at the University of Fort Hare. And in those days, some universities had had extensive staff accommodation on university premises, property, you know, and so on. And I think, well, my understanding of it is that it was as a way of escaping kind of direct intrusion by the apartheid state, right? So there was a loophole in the way in which university was structured that allowed them to have more say in their own property, you know, something around academic freedom or academic, not quite academic freedom, but the legislation that set up universities that allowed them to put people in housing that they wouldn't otherwise be able to put in. And so I grew up then in this kind of really really wonderful, but like really kind of out of step with the rest of the country context, because I grew up at the University of on the campus then of University of Fort Hare. And the housing was not just, it wasn't just the academic staff who lived on campus. Right? So there were all residential staff lived on campus. So people obviously who lived in a township nearby didn't live on campus. Okay. But there were staff accommodation. I mean, there were academic staff accommodation. There was academic staff accommodation. There was accommodation for the security guards. There was accommodation for the administrative staff. So it was different. It wasn't all the same accommodation. Mm. Like, I'm not so delusional as to, you know, as an adult now I can see, like, okay, it didn't all quite look the same.
Yeah.
But what it also meant, of course, was that people who wouldn't normally live in the same place. So whether it was because of ethnicity and weird and apartheid nonsense ideas about where Xhosas belonged and where Tswanas belonged, right? Or whether it was about the different kinds of blacks, so colored blacks and Indian blacks and African blacks wouldn't have lived in the same street or had been as neighbors, and certainly any kind of black would not have lived in the same place as white people. So you had then this kind of campus that had this mix on the one hand, right? So people living together and languages that probably, I mean, if I'd grown up anywhere else in the Eastern Cape, I would have probably grown up in a monolingual.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have lived next to people who were the Khwadis and spoke Sesotho and the Waltons who were so-called colored and you know, and so on. It would have been probably much more homogenous.
Mm.
But of course, I mean, the 70s and the 80s were, the 70s anyway, the early 70s, were also the height of the Black Consciousness Movement, right? And Fort Hare, I remember as a child going through various political kind of slight shifts in the politics of the campus. But I remember as a small child, one of the things I remember most vividly as a child, visually, are kind of black fists stenciled on the white walls of the male residences, right? And black power.
Mm.
So sprayed. I mean, now I know, I didn't know what they were. Like, I knew what they were, but I didn't know they were stenciled. But as an adult, I know it was a stencil, right? So as a child, I thought someone went out and drew it. And wrote black power, and then it would get painted over, and then they would go again, and they would do it, right? So I don't know who would paint it over, but it was white walls, so it was a very kind of stark image. And of course, people were saying black power all the time. And I didn't really speak English. I mean, I spoke, the first two languages I spoke were Xhosa and Sotho, which are the languages that my parents, the mother tongues of my parents. But But this, but black power clearly is a word, is a phrase. And I'm not, I mean, I remember it very distinctly. Right. And my parents used to like teasing that, or like proudly claiming that this is one of the first English things that I ever said. And I like this memory. I don't know if it's a real memory, but I like the memory because I remember the fists, right? Yeah. And I suppose it makes sense that I would have said black power and not know really without really understanding what that was. But of course, later on, the politics of the campus changing slightly, not becoming more conservative, but I guess becoming a more pronounced kind of version of kind of mix of black consciousness and more kind of anti-racist politics.
Yeah.
But I also remember, of course, that later on, by the time I was like in my by the kind of early 80s, I also remember the in the attempt to make the surrounding areas into this ridiculous thing called the CisGuy. Just how much under attack the campus was. So I remember a lot of tear gas. I remember a lot of, I remember, for example, the then supposed president of the supposed Republic of the CisGuy constantly trying to come on Forte and on, like, you know, because he was like,
physically
this is
to come
the CisGuy
on. Okay.
And students kind of stoning him and the cops. Yeah. You know, Jesus. The guy, I remember. So a very contested space. And I suppose part of what that is, you know, kind of drove home to me is that you know, education is political and universities are political, and of course, I mean, as an adult, it's so obvious now, but also that it's worth defending, right? Those students got arrested, and I mean, we hit people in our roofs all the time. I remember as a child, like, the cops would come through the houses, or they'd like, they'd ask, oh, we saw, they'd be chasing students across the campus, and you'd say, and they'd say, because they felt you were little. Well, you were little, so they thought you were going to tell.
You were little.
So they would say hi. They'd try to be nice to you. And you were not allowed to lie, but you were allowed to lie to cops.
Yeah.
Like, the only time you were allowed, like, lying is bad. Except, but lying to cops is okay. So the cops would come and they'd say, did you see someone? We saw someone run in this direction. And you knew exactly where your parents were hiding the person in the house. And you'd be like, no.
Well, I don't understand.
I don't. Yeah. He ran that way. He ran past the house. Or whatever. Jesus. Like, you just were like, I don't know. Jeez. And you knew exactly. Yeah. You were like, oh, hope they don't go in the house and find him.
Jesus.
So, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm just picturing your mind. I mean, you had to have been, I don't know what year exactly that was. We're talking 10 years old, 12 years old.
Yeah, even probably younger.
Younger.
Yeah.
And I'm picturing you, A, surrounded by black excellence as a norm.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, realizing how under attack this thing is.
Absolutely.
So one, it's normal, but also it's very not normal.
Absolutely.
Because clearly it's not a normal thing because people keep trying to attack us.
Absolutely. And I mean, on the black excellence thing, I mean, I think that also, yes, one of the great gifts.
Yeah.
I think of growing up on a black campus and at Forte, especially for me, is that it didn't just give me a very different sense of who I was as a black girl, a black person in the world. Not completely cushioned. I mean, I still, like, you know, like I like to say, Forte was a campus. It wasn't its own city. Like, we still shopped in the same place. I still went to black schools. Mm. Still went to the same hospital that my mom worked at. So it's not like the contrast was with Forte with the rest of the world. But one of the things that Forte gave me is not just this kind of being able to take for granted ideas about excellence, but also about what blackness means and what Africanness means, right? Because you were on a campus where, yes, you know, there were black sociologists and black social worker people and black religious studies people and black organic chemists, as my dad was, and this was normal, right? But also, of course, I didn't realize until I was in my early teens.
Mm.
I didn't realize how unusual it was to have an Indian neighbor and a Tswana neighbor and a colored neighbor and a Zulu neighbor and, like, for people to speak differently. It didn't become a thing until I was, but even more importantly for me as a Pan-Africanist, there were Namibians. There were people from Swaziland and from Lesotho and from different parts of the continent that I didn't even, that I would probably not have been able to find as a child on a map, right? And so it gave me a very different sense of I think often when you grow up in a country as regressive as apartheid was, there's so much attempt to make you think of yourself in the smallest possible way that to have the gift to think about myself as not Xhosa, right? Which I suppose if I'd grown up 20 kilometers up the road, yeah, that would have been the identity that would have mattered the most to me,
yeah,
right? But to be able to think of myself as black in this complicated way, and to be able to think about myself as African in this complicated way, and that as normal, right? But also of excellence and possibility as my entitlement in the world, but also very clearly, because I mean, it's not like we didn't realize we were in apartheid South Africa. We lived in apartheid South Africa. To realize that this is something worth defending. This is something precious that is constantly under attack, physically and in every other possible way, So I think it's kind of indelibly shaped who I would become and what I think is worth defending to this day.
I mean, it shows that you're doing the work, no doubt. And you speak about now moving from Fort Hare, where I suppose your identity is formed, and finding yourself at UCT a bit later in life, and the clash of, you know, your black consciousness and your politics at the time, with a more sort of liberal approach, and liberal can sometimes be used as an insult in a lot of spaces.
Yeah.
Do you remember that tension of you coming in and finding a, you know, very old establishment that has its own way of viewing things? And
yes, because I mean, also the thing is, you know, I enter UCT in 1990, right? So 1989, we finished matric. It's the burning 80s. And then while we're on holiday, F.W. de Klerk makes that speech. And we when we are in matric in 1989, everybody's saying, oh, freedom in our lifetime. But people have been saying this your whole life. Yeah, nobody really thinks. So to graduate in the country that is so proudly apartheid and that's on fire, and then suddenly while you're on holiday to begin your university, to have this sense of this country, a country that is on the brink of substantial change. Mandela's coming out of jail. I mean, Mandela had been in jail for like more than my life, right? For more than my entire life. And so we enter UCT, and it's interesting. And I think many of us who enter at that point, who finish school in one country, and also people are very strangely already in 1990 talking about a new South Africa. It's not a new South Africa. It's still apartheid South Africa. But people start saying new South Africa, new South Africa. But there is this sense of possibility.
Mm.
And so I think that then I probably enter UCT with my guard down a lot more than I would have ordinarily, right? Because it's not like I don't know that I'm going to be, I'm entering a university that is legitimate to a certain extent, claim to a contestatory kind of liberal, vibrant student, but it's still, anyway, I'm moving to UCT, and it's the first time I'm an obvious minority.
Okay.
Right? It's the first time I'm a minority. I mean, it's a white campus. On the one hand, campuses that are things that are not frightening to me, right? Having been brought up in the way that I was. On the other hand, I'm a South African. I'm a black South African. You know, I've been to all the schools I've been in have been schools that were either exclusively black or the last 2 years still majority black, right? So, and suddenly you enter this place and there's this kind of hopefulness and there's possibility, but at the same time, it's also a deeply racist space, right? And it speaks a certain kind of liberal politics. And there's that thing also, of course, about what liberal means and the difficult liberal thought historically and currently has with anti-racist traditions and black radical traditions. And so, I mean, UCT was very mixed, right? I was a teenager, so of course, I mean, I was a late teen. It was a changing country, so there were senses of kind of possibility and the recklessness that comes with being undergrads that I think everybody should have, right? and that it enabled in certain senses. And it was certainly a much more hopeful Cape Town than the Cape Town that I visit now, right? But at the same time, of course, there were these constant reminders, right? And the longer I stayed, I think, in fact, it became even more brutal in my postgrad years. Because in undergrad, there were that we were a minority, but there were still a lot of people, right? And you could choose. You had a wider range of people to choose from. I think for me, the post-grad experience was the that's where you really, because most, you know, there's so few of you, and now there's like, you're in a department where there's 40 post-grads and four of you are black, right? Or five of you are black and one of you is African-American, right? One of that five is African. So it's this kind of, and being keenly aware, not just of being a minority, but the stuff that makes you a minority. And just like a whole range of damaging things that happen in university, or just like in the kind of heart of whiteness more broadly. So yes, I mean, UCT was also a definitive, or defining rather, moment. Look, I mean, some of my closest friends are people that I met at UCT, and so they were wonderful people. But I mean, as an institution, you can imagine it was an institution that had resisted apartheid to a certain extent, but it wasn't it resisting apartheid in radical ways. So it wasn't. I'm sure it was nothing like probably the people who were moving in 1990 into Afrikaner universities, right? So the race script was a lot more hidden, and a lot more difficult to name and pinpoint necessarily most of the time. Although there were times it was quite stark. So
you mentioned this sort of insider outsider feeling of when you now start teaching, I believe, of you're now part of the institution, it's your employer, for better or worse, you represent this institution. At the same time, you're black in a decolonized space, you're a black woman in a decolonized space. I mean, sorry, in a not decolonized space.
Yes, in a colonized space.
In a colonized space.
Yes.
And so there's this tension between you are part of UCT, you represent it, but also obviously you can't possibly represent this thing, it doesn't represent you. Do you remember the early feelings of that and how that played out in your career?
I actually think at UCT they were probably less pronounced than they were in my later job, like in my first proper grown-up job. Because when I was teaching at UCT, I was still teaching kind of part-time. Okay. You know, I was a graduate student with some graduate teaching in the English department, which is where I was registered, but also in the academic development program, which is where I did a bit of teaching as well. And then I taught at a different university, then Technikon, what then called the Technikon, the Cape Technikon. So kind of a variety of teaching things. But I think the starkness of kind of feeling like an insider-outsider happened when I moved to my first grown-up job, you know, my first kind of full-time job at the University of the Orange Free State, as it then was called. And that, my goodness, it made me nostalgic for UCT. in many ways. Because, you know, black people, black people like to say this thing. Like we really like saying this thing. And I was like, I'm not sure about it. We like saying this thing of, oh, I'd rather have an honest right-wing person than a fake liberal.
Yeah.
And we say, people say, you hear this hundreds of times.
Yeah, like say to our faces, don't pretend.
And I was like, no, no. People who say that haven't had to deal with being 1% of black staff.
Jeez.
Haven't had to deal with students who launch right-wing protests to their lectures. Haven't had to deal with colleagues, with white colleagues whose cars get written Fox Ferrier, you know, race traitor on their bonnets. They haven't. It's not. And I remember saying to my friends constantly, no, are you kidding me? Of course I'd rather have UCT. UCT is not ideal, but I certainly would rather have UCT than another right-wing protest to another lecture of mine. And so, but it was also, you know, I mean, you know, it was also part of the time, right? It was part of the time. And I think that it was, I mean, as I entered that university, the conversation around transformation hadn't really started.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen some shifts, but I still don't really think, well, I shouldn't even water it down. We still don't really have a transformed university anyway in South Africa. So it was a different time, but I think many of those challenges are sometimes more hidden or different. But I think that in terms of there's still enormous problems and enormous, you know, kind of structural and everyday violence in our universities, you know. So we're very, very far from kind of having decolonized universities.
If I'm not wrong, the first, was it lecture or tutorial you ran was an intro to, was it to Black Consciousness?
Well, it was a literature, yes, it was,
like,
but I mean...
Come on, like, no. That, I read this and I was like, I mean, you could have eased in a bit. You could have,
no, I was doing something very boring and very mundane. They just made it a big thing.
Okay, so it actually wasn't as...
So yeah. I was teaching in the literature department.
Okay.
And I was and it was a South African literature course.
Sure.
Right? And so part of how you trained into literary studies is that you, part of the introduction, you try to give your students a sense of the spirit of the time
okay.
that the literature comes from.
Okay.
So in the same way that when I taught Shakespeare, I would talk about Renaissance England so that, because your students aren't living in Renaissance England. They don't know what Shakespeare, and it's important. You can't just come in and say, okay, so we're going to do Romeo and Juliet this week and Hamlet next week.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, what on earth is this? And what is he on about? Right? So part of how you teach literary studies, how you trained into the discipline, and I'd been trained into the discipline, is you go and you say, you give the people a sense of, it's not sociological, it's kind of historical context.
Yeah.
So you're trying to paint a very clear picture of what are people thinking? What does it look like? What are people wearing? What are they think? What are the overriding ideologies, aesthetics? What are the obsessions of the time? What are the pleasures of the time? Right. So I would go in. You know, if it were for first class on Shakespeare, I would have gone in and explained about, you know, what Renaissance is. What is the reawakening from? What are people looking like? What do the streets look like? What do people look like? What are they? How do they understand their place in the hierarchy? I would talk about the great chain of being. I would talk about what is taken for granted about who belongs where, about hierarchy, about the spiritual, about what are people afraid of? What are they so excited about? What's going on? What do the little jokes mean? Why would kind of I biting my thumb at you have been such a big thing? Because of course, if you're reading it in the 20th century or 21st century, you're like, yeah, okay, so what are they doing? You know, so I would have to explain what was sort of like the zip sign, right? And then they'd be like, oh, now I understand why someone draws his sword. You're right. So you would do that.
Yeah.
But I was teaching, I was starting a South African literature component. Somebody had done the drum decade, up until the drum decade.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to do from kind of Stuff Rider onwards. So, of course, I come in and I say, well, this is what South Africa looks like
what's
at the time.
yeah.
And these people that I'm
going
to start with are, you know, and Stuff Rider. And Stuff Rider is a Black Consciousness magazine.
Yeah.
It was heavily influenced by Black Consciousness. But it's 1997, right?
Yeah.
I was alive at part of it, right, as a child. But none of the students in my class know what I'm talking about, right? Like, they weren't born. So I have to, but even if they had been, I would still have to do the work.
Yeah.
So I just say, like, so that's what it was. I was introducing them to what, so then I had to say, well, they're Black Consciousness writers.
Yeah.
But what is that? What is Black Consciousness?
Why is it necessary? Yeah.
So then I said, well, this is what they're doing, and this is why, you know, and of course, Black Consciousness had a very specific relationship between, you know, this notion that art was supposed to be transformative, right? But this idea also of kind of Black liberation, psychological liberation, as important and a part of how you teach Blackness. You help people transform into Blackness.
Mm.
And of course, the creative is a big part of this, of psychological liberation. So of course, I had to say, like, explain what psychological liberation is. So, in some senses, it was actually a very unremarkable class, right? In terms of, but of course it was remarkable, right? Because here you are on this campus that has a very strong sense of conservative Afrikaner pride, right? A very clear sense of being under threat now. And also a very strong Bruderbond presence, right? So people are, so how dare you come with this stuff about white supremacy not being legitimate? And how dare you say anything about race? And how dare you, and yes, so there was a right-wing protest by two groups, one called Die Here 17, which are named after the board of directors of the Dutch East India Company, and the Quilerinas, who are named after Marie de Quilerina, who Quilerie, God, I can't remember now exactly what the surname is, who was Jan van Riebeek's wife. So kind of very right wing, very affronted by like, what the hell is this, right? And of course, on top, layered already on top of the fact that I was teaching in an English department, and there were tensions, there were very clear tensions between Afrikaners and English, as it is. So as if we don't have to suffer through this English nonsense as it is, now there's blackness on top of, like, you know, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so there was a protest after
my first.
And then I thought, jeez, that killed my naivety in a second.
And I mean, that's firstly hell of a start to your career. Hell of a start. I'm curious. I'm dropping a whole portion of your life now and thinking now, you know, when you're at WITS, there's the decolonized movements, there's the four lists. And I'm just curious of how you experienced that, given you were at a, you know, historically black university with a great tradition. You've seen the possibility, right? You're not imagining this. You've seen it. At the same time, again, the insider outsider, you're part of WITS, you're employed by WITS, you are part of this thing, and I can imagine in some ways you're tied to what it is now. At the same time, the department and the people you're teaching are younger youths, right? So that's you. So I'm just curious of, you know, when the fallism begins and these are your students and it's your university, of just how you experience that given, you know, your life.
I suppose the big moment for me is not so much Fees Must Fall, which is important but comes later, but it's that weird moment that people treat like, where did this come from? It's Roads Must Fall, right? It's Roads Must Fall. And the thing is, for me, when it's interesting, it's happening at my alma mater, right? It's happening at UCT. It's these black students at UCT saying these things and doing these things. And I instantly recognize Roads Must Fall as legitimate.
Okay.
But that seems quite, again, to me, it seems quite like, makes perfect sense to me why that's happening there, right? Even though we live in a country that talks about born frees and apathetic youth and da-da-da. I mean, when you teach students, when you teach 17 and 18 and 19 and 20 and 21 and 22-year-olds, you sometimes listen to the public discourse about apathetic youth, disinterested, spoiled, entitled, and you think, who are they talking about? I teach these people all the time. I talk to young people on different campuses all the time. Maybe university students are a specific kind of student.
Yeah.
But I work, you know, I do different work with different universities. I mean, I'm employed by one, but... So it wasn't surprising to me. I mean, there was a very clear sense that there was a brewing radicalization that had been happening for a while, you know, with things like Blackwash at kind of, you know, prior to Roads Must Fall and so on. But what was striking to me about Roads Must Fall and then Fees Must Fall after that was the way in which so many other people in my country or who live in this country was so taken aback and didn't think there was a problem. But also the very clear sense of the very clear misunderstanding of what campuses looked like, of what the experience of students was. So I think with many people that I'd been at university, my generation, there was a sense that, first of all, people thought that students were living the same kinds of lives that we would have, right? So they hadn't really appreciated just how stark the economic reality is on campuses, right? They'd left campus, so the effects of outsourcing, because, I mean, when we were students, the outsourcing thing was just starting.
Okay.
Right? We had canteens on campus. We had, when you paid for res, you had catering, like it included your food in res. Whereas we had been saying as academics for a long time, we have students passing out from hunger in classes. Mm. We have students sleeping in lecture theaters and libraries and under stairs. We have some of our brightest are being excluded for financial, not academic reasons, right? And I think it was inevitable. It was an explosion that was inevitable.
Okay.
And also, of course, then there's the absolute denial and the refusal of higher education to transform significantly. And so fallism made instant sense to me.
No surprise.
It made absolutely no surprise. What was surprising to me was how everybody else seemed to like not get why. What do you mean? What's wrong with these kids?
Yeah.
What are they talking about? And also, of course, part of it, I understand now. Because if part of it was also a refusal to accept that the strategies of student movements prior to that had not succeeded beyond a certain point, right? We were also wedded to transformation, but transformation hasn't happened.
Okay.
Right? And transformation has happened and it hasn't happened. So we managed to get majority black students on campuses, but staff numbers have not changed.
Yeah.
Right? And there have been all of these programs over and over again. And also children, you know, these students were saying, I'm sorry, but people, the vast majority of people who come in to clean our universities, making universities habitable, are not making enough money to be able to just transport themselves back and forth. Never mind get their own, they have to be reminded constantly of how their children will never be able to access education. At the same time that we're living in a country where we just lie about if you work hard, you'll get in. That's not true. That's not true. You can get in, but you're not going to get in because you're not going to be able to pay.
Getting in doesn't mean, you know.
Exactly. You're not going to be able to pay. And you might get, and a huge percentage of who gets in can't finish because of money.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and they were saying, we really believe the thing that you all say is true about educational, education allows you to be able to do certain things, but we're not having access to education. And these institutions are not changing. And this is violent. And it's unacceptable, and it's not the time for negotiation and talking about transformation and coming up with strategies that just get sabotaged anymore. Those have not. It's time to reflect and to come up with new strategies. And those strategies, of course, are going to be impatient because, I'm sorry, it's been 2 decades. If 2 decades is not the time to be impatient, when is?
Yeah.
I mean, it is absolutely unacceptable that 20 plus in the third decade of our democracy, we have our brightest. Now, the ones we say are our brightest and our most determined and our most driven, right? Because that's who makes it, right? Not just our brightest, but you have to be all of those combinations still being pushed out of the system because they can't afford to pay fees. So they can't get into the best universities, or they can afford to pay fees for a time but still have to leave because all are leaving and being so indebted that actually they can't live meaningful lives. Like something else, there has to be some other way to transform the society, and maybe transform is the problem. And so all of it made instant sense to me. You know, I recognized that we are too close to the universities that we studied in, and that. You know, we're too close to that reality than the reality that we should be approaching. And so what was interesting, of course, is that later on, both in response to, I mean, so people were outraged, of course, by Roads Must Fall, and were outraged by Fees Must Fall. And I think, honestly, I think in the main, Fees Must Fall has been dealt with, has been handled by most universities incredibly unimaginatively, at best. With a few people willing to change their minds, and that's notable, and that's important to note. But I think also the amount of brutality with which students in Fees Must Fall has been met is actually completely inexcusable. And I think we're going to pay for that, right? And so sometimes you hear people boasting about having quashed Fees Must Fall. Universities talking about, university kind of managers talking about, some throughout the country talking about having successfully quashed. And I think that's a, you know, they live in a fool's paradise, because the impatience and the rage are A, legitimate, but also B, are not just going to go away. Like, there's no, where in history has this ever worked? That, okay, we're going to shoot you, or we're going to jail you, we're going to drive you underground, we're going to imprison you, and therefore we're going to kill this movement. It doesn't work like that, right? So I think we're sitting on a ticking time bomb, which is linked to various other things that we're just not confronting in the society around the deepening poverty and the deepening marginalization. So I don't think Fees Must Fall is completely out of step with I think we paid attention because here were kids in our Ivy Towers saying what people in social movements have been saying for the last 20 years. And we pay attention to what UCT kids say. We pay attention to what Vets kids say. We pay attention to what Rhodes kids say, the university currently known as Rhodes students say, right? Because but it was happening at other universities. It was happening outside of universities for much longer. And it's a collective rage that is legitimate, that requires vision, not more tear gas.
Yeah.
And repression.
More imagination, perhaps. I don't have too much time, so I'm going to clump some ideas together. In one of the essays or chapters, you pay tribute to Winnie Madikizela Mandela, Wambui Otieno, or the third person I'm missing?
Matai.
Wangari Matai, exactly. And in another, you talk about the Remember Kwesi protest and try and place that in sort of a, you know, traditional feminist protest lineage, for lack of a better word. Why is that important? And this is the generational thing I see. Why is it important to you to say, to pay tribute to these three people, to also talk about yourself and to also say, hey, look, this is important and this is us and this is the same thing that we've been doing. Why was that important to draw?
I think it's absolutely, women like so the chapter on Winnie Mandela and Wangari Maathai and Wambui Wayake Otieno is about several things for me.
Yeah.
Thirdly, just because the three of them with different levels are just kind of activist, outspoken, historically important women that I've been fascinated by for a long time. I mean, in the case of Wambui Otieno, I just really came pretty close to just about worshipping her, right? So she's like my obsession.
Okay.
She was when she was alive. And
if you don't know the story, you have to buy the book and get on this.
And I think that it's important to me for various reasons. I think it's important to, especially at this time, but perhaps it always has been important, to have a sense of perspective of the fact that African feminists today, women and girls and trans people who don't want to be controlled are not an anomaly, right? That there's a long, I think we're very often taught to know and worship and recognize and celebrate some of what are often called the founding fathers of African liberation. And there's very little attention paid to the way in which difficult women and women's movements on this continent and everywhere else in the world have shaped the world that we live in. And also, of course, in many ways, if you look at someone those three women are very different women, right? They're very similar in the sense that they're activists and they're unbowed and they're courageous and they're outspoken and they're difficult. What is wonderful to me about their lives is also about how, in the face of enormous attempts to silence them, make them smaller, erase them from history, we know their names, right? There are many others like them whose names we don't know. And so part of what's fascinating is how they celebrate a triumph over erasure, right? But I'm not interested in celebrating them as, or reading them and valuing them as heroes. Right. I think I like, of course, there's something heroic about them. But I think that often heroism is about exception. There's only one. You are so much unlike everybody else.
Yeah.
And yet part of why they're important to me is because I recognize something about many women and many girls and many kind of progressive men in them. Right. That kind of defiant, the inability to just kind of lay down and even when confronted with enormous kind of violence and attempts to silence you. So I think that's important. I think a sense of historical consciousness of defiant, self-owning, flawed, because they're human beings.
Yeah.
Women is important. I think it's important for this time where feminist movements, where feminists, where trans people, where queer people, where any LGBTI people, where any kind of progressive sentiment is often made to seem so alien, like you are the crazies, this is not African, your homosexuality is not African, feminism is not African. that in fact that's nonsense. We have long traditions of radical Africans of different kinds.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that the conservatives don't then, the conservative ethnic nationalists, hyper-religious right-wing homophobes don't get to define everything for us, and we constantly on the back foot. So some of it is about saying, look, no, there's a way to claim that these people are actually acting in a, you know, part of it is about, so with the Rimba quiz, it's part of saying they acting in a long tradition of women who insisted on speaking for themselves.
Yeah, perfectly consistent with what has come
they're
before.
Not so strange. They're not doing some weird thing. They're not pawns.
Yeah.
They're speaking for themselves. And in fact, the misunderstanding and the refusal to completely engage what they're saying and their messaging and their radical politics is also part of a long tradition of refusal to engage kind of radical subjectivity and radical women's movements in this country. And I think it's important because I think it's you know, we're constantly battling against erasure. We're constantly battling the thing that says nobody before in the history of Africa has ever, right? And yet we have this rich tradition. And if we're saying we're working in universities, for example, that are not decolonized, we're saying we have an education system before university that's collapsing, where is this sense of historical context supposed to come from, right? So it's not easily available.
Yeah.
So it's possible for people to think, I'm the first person to ever think, right? And what a horrible place to be. What an isolating, lonely, unnecessarily so place to be, when actually history is rich and saturated and brimming with people who were as crazy as you, who were as interested in expanding freedom for everybody as you are. And so that's what those two projects are about. But also, of course, because I'm obsessed with Odierno, so at any given time I'm very happy
to just talk about slaughter
it.
In
I
the story.
Have a whole 3-hour conversation with you where we're just talking about Wambui Odierno, because I just can't get over how incredible she was, you know, and she literally energizes me. I mean, when she died, I'd never met her personally, but I've been obsessed with her for a long time. When she, I felt like somebody, I've never been so affected by the death of someone I didn't have a close personal relationship. And when she died, I physically felt ill. Like, now they've taken her from me. I don't know who they is, but, you know, she's, and I don't take that importance for granted, right? I think that it's, there's a reason why she felt so important to me, that living her own life, making those weird, wonderful, crazy decisions enabled me to feel at home in ways that I wouldn't have been without her in the world.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have. I could easily do this all day. Thank you for your generosity in this interview and also in the book. It's not a memoir, as you've mentioned many times, but it's very personal, and I think you really give us a sense of what shapes who you are, where you're, you know, some context to where ideas come from, and you help us think through things like the Rainbow Nation, things like the Remember Kwesi protest. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Kingsley. I've had so much fun.
Wonderful. For everybody tuning in, as I mentioned, the book is Reflecting Rogue, Inside the Mind of a Feminist by Professor Pumla Dineo-Kola. Please go and get yourself a copy, and you can find out what's going on in there. Tremendous, tremendous work. And we look forward to hearing what you think about this interview and the book itself. Remember, you can download the podcast. You can share it far and wide with your friends and family. And we'll be back next week. Same time, same place. Daily Migrant Show and CliffCentral.com.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show. Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com. This is CliffCentral.com.